Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. Here District, the Fantastic Voyage is... We're setting sail, Chris. The Fantastic Voyage has set sail. Finally, training camp has started in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The Bucks are in camp. This is Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson. We are the only father and son combo, two-piece combo that has won a national championship, NCAA championship at the same school. Chris in 1995 as a freshman, me in 1975, John Wooden's last championship. Chris, here District, give me some.
Well, you can give listen. Me some. You can listen to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or you can watch live versions of this episode on the Bucks official YouTube channel.
Well, a lot going on in the basketball world. The ladies are involved in the WNBA finals. A lot of controversial stuff coming out in terms of comments about the commissioner, and we'll have Shimmy Miller, WNBA analyst with the Chicago Sky, also Big Ten Network, to come on and talk about some of that. But first, man, let's talk about these Milwaukee Bucks. And I guess the news of the day would be no Giannis. Giannis has COVID. Giannis had to stay behind for a few days in Greece, couldn't make the start of camp, which I don't know about you, Chris. I don't have a problem with. He talked about not being there for his teammates, but another two-week rest for him after Eurobasket. It's not like he's been laying around all summer long and now all of a sudden needs this to get in shape. He's in shape, and right so now his body probably needs a rest. Go ahead.
So I'm curious. So if he would not have played at Eurobasket and he had been just chilling in Greece, caught COVID, would you have been okay with this still?
Yes. And here's why. Because we know this season for Giannis, point Giannis, as you refer to it, his usage rate is going to go way up. He's probably going to play. If I'm Doc Rivers, I'm looking at 35 minutes a game. I mean, back under Coach Budenholzer, sometimes, because he would play as little as 30, 31 minutes a game, which I thought
was far too few.
I couldn't believe it. Well, the playoffs, you got to bump that up to 36, 37, 38 minutes a game, at least for a guy like him.
But he was getting crazy numbers in those 30 minutes, though. Well, That's the part I'm talking about.
Yeah, still dropping 30 points a game.
That's what I'm saying. It was unbelievable.
13, 14 rebounds. And ludicrous. The Bucks were all, but that's when, you know, Coach Bud, and to his, you know, in defense of him and to his credit, this team was winning, you know, 60 games one year. I mean, so this was like, you know, you had opportunities to rest he and Chris Middleton, but I always thought it would come back and bite them just because the playoffs intensified. So he's going to play a lot of minutes. And so, just to ease into it as opposed to trying to hit the ground running. Now, I give Giannis a lot of props. Because of his enthusiasm for this season, for this team, for the rejiggered Bucks in terms of the youth movement that John Horst and Milt Newton and staff have ushered in. And so he's raring to go. But I don't think it's a bad thing, you know, at all for him to get a little bit more rest, to come ease himself into the flow. And, you know, the old Boston Celtics, I remember Don Nelson telling us, like a John Havlicek would maybe hold out and try and get more money, and they'd go to training camp and he'd be on the dock fishing as they passed by him. But you knew when it was time for game time to start that he was going to be ready. I have no doubts in my mind that Giannis is going to be ready, but it was a little, you know, it was surprising, I guess, for me when I heard that he was not going to start camp off. But the more I thought about it, the more okay I was with it. So, well,
I love how the Bucks kept that under wraps. None of us had any clue what was going on until, you know, the very last minute. And I also think that this is a good time for the Giannis-less Bucks to establish a system that isn't totally reliant on Giannis, right? Now you get to sort of fill out some chemistry with yourself. Miles Turner is probably taking, you know, a larger, more assertive role early on in camp, allowing him to find his voice as well in terms of leadership and all that type of stuff that's necessary with NBA vets and those type of situations, and the chemistry aspect. I mean, I'm not saying it like, oh, this is going to be, you know, make or break the Bucks season, but there's something to be said about building chemistry without your star when you're going to have to play a lot of games and a lot of time this season without Giannis on the floor.
So Doc comes out, Chris, and pretty much just anoints Kevin Porter Jr. as the starting point guard.
Yeah, and we've been saying it all summer. We've been saying it all summer, though.
But I like the way Doc kind of couched it in terms of, you know, it's going to be some good days, going to be some challenging days, but we're going to roll with it. We're going to let him play through it. You know, he's still a young man. He's been in this league for a while. He's had some success. He's had some down issues and things that have happened for him. So we're going to be patient with him. But I like the fact – we've been saying it all summer, but Doc just comes out and makes no mistake about who, what, when, and where is going to have the ball in his hands as the point guard. Giannis obviously is going to do a lot of the playmaking. But just to say, Kevin Porter Jr., you know, at ease, relax, bro. This is your spot. This is how we're starting out. I think for a guy in Kevin Porter Jr.'s mindset right now, coming off the finish of the season he had last year, this was the right call on the part of Doc Rivers.
And those Kevin Porter Jr. strikes me as one of those type of dudes where this vote of confidence will go a long way in him locking in him staying on the path of the straight and narrow, him doing all the right stuff, him, you know, understanding that in the game, understanding that what's expected of him is consistency. So I feel like this is going to go far in helping to add that. The other thing that I love what Doc does and some of his quotes coming out of camp, you know, he was talking about Cole Anthony and Ryan Rollins and kind of how, you know, he's like, you know, we got a bunch of guards, you know, everybody, you know, it's not just a point guard situation. These guys are guards. So meaning, you know, he can play them off the ball as well. And so that to me means a lot. Also, one other thing, MJ, I don't know if you're going to cover this, but just the Amir Coffey situation we have been talking about all summer. Amir coming out of, you know, the first couple of days at camp, Doc was raving about him. You know, Amir kind of had some quotes that were very interesting that kind of alluded to a vote of confidence from Doc that he would be given every opportunity to make this team. And so when we're looking at, you know, who's going to be on that final roster at the wing slot, I think that that's you know, I'm watching this closely because every day I'm looking for tidbits just to kind of see, check the temperature and just kind of have a barometer of what's going on.
Well, and I'm looking for, there was a list of players. I don't have it at my fingertips, but like there's two spots available and four or five guys. Kind of, so Amir was one. Andre Jackson
here's,
Jr.
Here's the breakdown. As it stands, there are five Bucks competing for the last three roster spots. Amir Coffey, Gary Harris, Tyler Smith, Chris Livingston, Andre Jackson. Now, of the five, Amir Coffey is non-guaranteed. Ajax is partially guaranteed. The other three are on guaranteed deals.
Which means that, you know.
You tell me.
If you keep Amir Coffey, you're going to have to eat some money. You're going to have to eat some contracts.
And you're
I think Andre Jackson Jr. is not guaranteed until the end of the month it kicks in.
And that, so now it's time to really re-examine the details of Ajax's kind of new contract that they did. How much exactly was the raise? I think it was $800,000 that the Bucks might be on the hook for, or whatever it is. You know, it's like you got to look at, you got to see now. You know, it's like how much is Livingston weighing? How much is Tyler Smith, Gary Harris?
And so a little birdie has also told me, I've got my spies out there that report to me on a daily basis that Miles Turner is playing great basketball. Ryan Rollins, even though he just came back from shoulder surgery, is really looking good here early, kind of, you know, gearing up for 5-on-5. AJ Green, no surprise. He is looking like he's ready to come in and just grab him some minutes. Give me those McGaffle some minutes. Give me those minutes. And then Taurean Prince, who spent the entire offseason in Milwaukee, in the community. I see him around at different community events. He and his two beautiful kids just, in, you know, soaking in the whole Milwaukee vibe. But I've heard he is looking really good right now. But the guy I want to talk about is a guy that's working out with a buddy of yours, a guy that you've spent a lot of time training players with, Clint Parks. But Kyle Kuzma is one of, you know, Clint's proteges. He's been training Kyle since he's coming to the league out of Utah, you know, whatever it was, 7-8 years ago, whatever it's been. It's probably longer than that now. But I like Doc's comments about Kyle. He talks about shot profile and how Kyle kind of got used to shooting mid-range shots and not those high-value shots when he was playing with the Wizards. They want to get him back into thinking about shot profile. And, man, that means an awful lot.
Explicit focus this offseason was refining his three-point shot and trying to figure out ways to get to the cup. Threes and lays, right? Those are the two shots that highly efficient. That's kind of, he had this mid-range shot diet in Washington, which I can understand him falling into that. I'm sure playing with that system and losing sort of culture, analytics, yay, schmanalytics. Like, who gives a crap about, but I'm just saying, like, you know, why am I going to try to adhere to the analytics here if I'm in Washington? So now he's in Washington, he's in Milwaukee. He had a very subpar by his own standards his first year. He has a lot to prove this year. I've been in constant contact with Clint, who may or may not be joining the show pretty soon here. We can really get into depth about the work that he put in with Kuz. Spent 2 weeks in Dusseldorf, Germany with Kuz recently, earlier last month, in the month of September. And so I'm expecting big things out of Kuz this season.
Well, and you know what the telltale sign is for me that Kuz is ready?
The hair?
The hair, dude. He's got the bald look. You know, he's got the bad. It's no blonde. It's no Jerry curl. It's none of this. You know.
I think it's a tint of blonde in there.
It's a different look. You know, I'm coming in because I want to feel different about who I am as a basketball player. Different mindset, different season. I'm throwing the old Kuz to the trash bin. This is the new Kuz, and this look exemplifies this. And I used to do that, man. Sometimes mustache, sometimes no mustache, sometimes a partner. You know, I was first team all pro, but I put the partner aside, kind of just off center. You know,
the part was one of the sickest looks you ever rocked in your whole life. Dog, when I saw that Joan, I was like, what is he doing? Yeah. But you only did clean shave, what, once?
One year, my second year, when I made first team all pro.
First team all pro.
I was clean shave. I averaged 26 points a game. You know, but the point is that's part of a basketball player's aura. You know, people don't understand. It's the sweatband. It's the elbow. I had an elbow pad sometimes, the knee pad, not because my knees were hurting, but it's just because it's a warrior thing. I'm like a warrior going to battle, and this is like part of my warrior gear. And for Kuz, it's all about the different hair look, man. He coming in. Doc is throwing down the gauntlet. We want shot profile. We want threes. We want layups. We forget about all this mid-range stuff. And to Doc's defense, last year, Kuz, his three-point frequency was at 34% of his field goal attempts, 27th percentile, which is terrible. And then mid-range shots, he was in the 80th percentile in terms of how frequently he took a mid-range shot, 34%. So you want to flip-flop that thing around, and I think Kuz is ready to take the challenge. Now, you still think, I'm listening to the 520 podcast with Jeff Teague, and they're talking about Kuz as a sixth man. I think we had talked about that a bit early on. Do you feel like this is going to how it's going to eventually shake down for Kyle Kuzma, and why?
I can't see the Bucks playing, starting out the season with Kuz at the three. I just don't think, I don't know. It might be his situation, and it might be the three, but I just feel like he's going to be more of a 3-4 this year. I think he's going to eat a lot more minutes at the three and the four because of the logjam with so many perimeter guys. The guy's going to have to play up a position, right? So now you're going to have guys slotting in at the GTJ at the three. You know, you're going to have guys that, like, you're going to have to play that three role with one of these 3-and-D wing guys. So the only other role that Kuz has where the Bucks are really light on depth would be a small ball four type.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think about that? Am I off base for thinking this, or do you think because of Doc's conventionality, whatever the word is, of the way he coaches, that he's going to start Kuz at the three, Giannis, Miles, KPJ at the one, and then AJ or Gary Trent at the two? Is that how you think it's going to shake out, MJ?
Well, here's my thinking. And I'm, you know, and put myself in the mind of Doc Rivers. You like to have an ace in the hole. And if that triumvirate, that small ball lineup is a lineup maybe you close with. You know, if you start Kuz And then you've got something, you've got a change of speed pitch. You've got some ability to diversify and throw your opponent off balance a bit because of a different look. You know what I'm saying? So yeah. so now you can if you start with the guys like he did in Indiana, the Pacers in game five, the closeout game, they played exceptionally well. But I still think Doc may try and hold that as his ace in the hole, throw that lineup at teams like he did so effectively. That a lineup in the fourth quarters this past season just changed the whole game around. You go small, you go perimeter oriented, you get three guys that can shoot 40% or better from the 3-point line, three guys that are forcing Chris 16.9 turnovers per game when they're out there together. Those three.
So,
go.
No, but my thing is this. So your thing is having that curveball, that change of speed pitch that you'll be able to throw in on teams in the quarters where they have shown to be most effective. So save the triumvirate for the fourth. But we don't mess with Kuz's head by not starting him.
Bam.
We empower Kuz. We get him going early. He may not finish. He may or may not finish. Yeah. But at least we're not effing his head off by telling him from the outset, hey, you're coming off the bench because of whatever we think that might do to Kuz. That makes sense, though, MJ. And that's more of the nuance of NBA that you have to like keep into account.
And as you say, so you start him, and so there'll be some games when he's getting off. He's playing like he played the final game of the season against the Detroit Pistons when he had 22 points in the first quarter. Not at that exceptional level, but you get what I'm saying. He's coming out gangbusters. He's knocking down threes. They say he's shooting the ball extremely well, playing great defense, using his limp. Doc talked about him in camp early on, getting downhill. Kuz has gotten downhill so effectively, getting downhill. You want it, man. You want to, I don't think you want to mess with that. I think you want to have that carry over into the regular season, at least on opening night. You see how it goes. If it's not working out for some reason or another, you can always make a change. But to your point, at least you don't mess with his head right off the bat.
You give him
the same way you do it with KPJ, naming him as starter, you know, day one. With Kuz, you want his confidence at a certain level to get the best Kuz, the best version of Kuz that you can possibly get. So that's speculation, but I think Doc could very well go that route.
And last thing on this, you make some great points. I think that Doc is that type of man, that type of coach that will keep that in mind. Like that's the stuff Doc be thinking about when he's making a decision. Like, it's, you know, I don't want to screw up KPJ's stuff, and I don't want to mess with Kuz's stuff, because I know if I unlock both of them, if I unlock KPJ and Kyle Kuzma, our ceiling, as Jordan said, is the freaking roof.
Yeah. And it's not always about the best players starting. It's a lot more involved than that, especially on the NBA level. It's the psychology of understanding how to work with players, how to get the most out of players, how to keep their confidence at a high level. And that's one of the reasons why Doc Rivers is top 10 all times in wins in the history of this league, because he's got that understanding. You can say what you want about whatever you want to say about Doc Rivers, but Doc knows, he knows the inner workings of a player's mindset. That's one thing that he knows. I've seen it up close and personally. I knew it was there, but I've seen it since he's been in Milwaukee, and I think that could be an approach that he takes. Now, so that brings us to the two-guard spot. Are you penciling in GT2 automatically? No if, ands, or buts.
I mean, look, I don't want to read too much into training camp or what little birdies are telling you, but if your little birdie is not bringing up GTJ, bruh, and he's talking about AJ, I don't know. I think I got to go with AJ. No, but here's what I'm going to say. No, because I'm not going to flip-flop and be wishy-washy. Yeah. I'm going to still believe in GTJ.
Yeah,
we remember last year the struggles that he had because of the nagging, growing injury and this and that. But if there's anything that we do know about Gary Trent Jr., especially after talking to his pop, that mentally he's going to come in, not just mentally, but physically prepared, mentally prepared. And no matter what he's going to go through, he's not a guy that's going to quit. And so he can go start the season 3 for 28 all you want. He's going to be there for, 8, 7, 8 threes, 37 against the Pacers at the end of the day. You know what type of confidence it takes a person to maintain, to not completely go down in the doldrums after starting the season like that? Everybody's talking about you. You're just looking bad and you're losing. The Bucks start 2-8. That taught me a lot about Gary Trent Jr., but after talking to his pops and having him right here on this show, I totally get why that dude's built the way he is. So I would go with GT.
Yeah, and Giannis talked about we got a team full of dogs, and you know, between Kevin Porter Jr., between Gary Trent. I mean, I think those guys are dogs on defense too. I mean, those are guys that, and to that point, my little birdie, training camp birdie, told me that the Bucks are picking up full court.
They want. What did we force, say? They what did we say?
More, they want to force more turnovers this season, Chris.
Got that. See, the thing is, MJ, you know, we kind of talked about this stuff kind of like in a way that was like, oh, man, wishful thinking, right? Dude, yeah. We're seeing a lot of the stuff that we wish for starting to come to fruition. It started with the roster, 13 guys, 12 guys under the age of 26. Okay, yeah. We're in the modern era. Now Doc's talking about utilizing this depth, utilizing these legs, and the only way you do that is by picking up full and getting dudes tired and then running more dudes in doing the same thing. So that's exciting. That's exciting. Yeah,
yeah. Well, and so here's the number for you. I had pulled up from Second Spectrum. The Bucks ranked 21st. On 3-point field goal attempts off of live ball turnovers last year, 1.9 a game. Golden State was number one at 2.8. And I was told, I had my man do some math, that if the Bucks can move up to the 21st, move up into the top 10, they finished 10th in turnovers forced, that adds to at least one more 3-point field goal made per game for them. And so that puts them right in the mix, right where they want to be. So forcing turnovers, I think, for Doc Rivers. He's talking about being intentional when increasing the 3-point attempts, and that's one way you can be intentional in doing that.
Absolutely. It goes into what we're talking about with Eric Name on the last episode as far as the ways to increase the Milwaukee Bucks 3-point rate so that they are finished in the top 10. Forcing turnovers is definitely one of them, kicking ahead, and then offensive rebound kickouts. Like the concerted effort, MJ, when you get a board, shooters spacing, you know, spacing, shaping up, rebounders. We're looking automatically for shooters. You know what I'm saying? And that's how you increase that 3-point rate, a combination of everything.
Yeah. Ball reversal. The Bucks could do a much better job in terms of generating 3-point shots and kick out passes. They were number 18 in the league. 3-point field goal attempts.
Let me ask you this. Okay. Do you care if part of this Milwaukee Bucks campaign to increase their 3-point rate, do you care if Giannis is hunting threes? So if they can't see you at home, if they can't see you, tell
me. I don't care. No. And here's my thing with Giannis. I was shaking my head no for those that couldn't see me. Here's my thing with Giannis. Even during the seasons when he was shooting, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it seemed like 3 or 4 or 5 3-point field goal attempts per game. He was down in the high 20s or whatever. And you had fans online saying Giannis should never, ever take a 3-point field goal. My thing, you got to let Giannis be Giannis. Now, Giannis has come out and said and stated that he is going to take more 3-point shots this year. I've heard from Vin Baker, who has told me, Drew Hanlon, we talked about it with Eric Name. He's shooting the ball exceptionally well. Didn't get a chance to show it in Eurobasket because they haven't played like a conventional big, you know, going closer to the basket. But I think at the very start, at the very least, you got to let's see what's there. That's my thing with Giannis. You got to give him some freedom to be Giannis, to have him just explore the full, you know, Giannis-ness of his game. And if the 3-point shot is working on some nights, I don't mind him shooting 7, 8 3-point shots a game if he's knocking down 3 or 4 of them. You know,
It just depends on if it's working or not.
But you gotta trust. See, this trust word that we talked about with Doc and KPJ, Doc with Gary Trent, Doc with Kyle Kuzma.
Yes, sir.
You gotta trust that he's at a point in his career, at 30 years old, 13th year in the league, 2-time MVP. He's got enough sense to know if he's on or if he's not on. And not to shoot you out of a game by just jacking up threes because he's open. Coach, I'm open. Yeah, well, there's a reason why you're open because you're not.
But does he? But I'm not trying to knock Giannis here, but does he? We saw last season.
And he didn't take a lot last year.
And I heard you on air on some of the transition pull-ups, threes. You are very happy. Why would Giannis take that in that situation and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not trying to single you out, but all I'm saying is, will he know the difference? Will he keep jacking?
Yeah,
will he know the difference?
And I would venture to say that I had complaints about his 3-point shot selection. If 5 times the whole year, that was a lot. If there was on occasion in a close game,
I'm being particular because I hear every single one.
You're down 4, and he comes down early.
Yes.
And he hasn't taken one all game long. I mean, those to me are kind of out of rhythm threes that I complain about with him.
Okay.
But for the most part, I think he's at a point in the work that he's put in with Drew, with Vin Baker. Vince spent 3 months over in Greece, in Athens, you know, working out with him daily on his shot. We talked about Drew Hanlon telling Giannis, you know, we're not going to work on mechanics so much as repetition. Just a lot of reps. It's just if you're making it, keep doing what you're doing to make that shot. So, you know, I don't have a problem with that to start out with. To that point, let's talk about the Bucks' big triumvirate of Giannis, Miles Turner, Bobby Portis. Is there a more versatile, for lack of a better word, three big rotation in the league than these three guys? A better three big rotation in terms of everything they bring to the table, shooting threes, Giannis rebounding, pushing it up, attacking the basket, Bobby Portis energy off the bench. Bobby was top 6 or 7 in 3-point field goal percentage just 3 or 4 years ago. So it's in there with him. Hadn't shown it recently, but he can shoot the basketball from the 3-point line. You think about the three big men rotations around the league. Does anybody else's team spring to mind that can make a case?
I would say Orlando off top.
Okay, that's good. That's
Wagner,
good. That's good.
Banchero. But who's my
Wendell? Wendell is Wendell still
Carter
there?
Jr. Carter Wendell Jr. Carter.
Yeah.
So I think isn't he there still? but I don't know why Orlando would come to mind. But here's my thing with the three big lineups. Like the shooting aspect of these three, with Turner being 39, Bobby being, I think he had a down year last year, but he's very capable. And Bobby, more than the percentages, will hit those big momentum changers or run extending threes, like when you really need it off that swing. Bobby, oh, Bucks up 10, TV timeout. Bobby's going to knock that down. The thing that I wonder about as far in terms of how much, I don't know if this question was based on, can we play them together? But I would look at just the concept of putting all three on the floor defensively would be very interesting to me, because I feel like Giannis is the kind of guy that can cover a tremendous amount of ground and do a good enough job at the small forward position defensively to where it could allow Miles and Bobby to do some things to free up some of the pressure that's on them. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever see something like this other than maybe exhibition season, but to answer your question, I don't think they're the most versatile three front court in the league. I think there are others that may be more versatile, but I think that this is definitely one of the most effective, especially with Giannis, not Miles Turner, Bobby Portis.
I'm racking my brain. So Houston would have KD, Şengün, and who would be their Tari Eason? Or, I mean, I'm trying to think of who that third big would be for them. I mean,
Capella?
I think Clint Capella is in Houston right now. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of just a role guy, rim, you know, stress on the rim type of a guy, great defensive player. So, yeah, I mean, but the Bucks are right up there. Those three, Giannis, Miles Turner, and Bobby are right there. So that's a good thing. And then Ryan Rollins, John Hollinger had a
your boy,
great,
your boy.
John had a great article on, you know, guys that were going to make an impact, kind of unsung guys are going to have an impact this season. I think Reed Shepard was one of those guys. Bunch of different players around the league. I got Kobe Bufkin, you know, was on that list.
Wow.
Ryan Rollins was on that list, and he based it on the numbers that Ryan put up as a starter, 11 points a game, over 42-43% from the three-point line. And, you know, I like, Chris, that you could have, you know, you can have a Kevin Porter Jr. starting, but you've got a Ryan Rollins as a backup point guard. You got a Cole Anthony as a. But you talked about all the solid guards. Cole Anthony's played well, got into the paint, did some great things early in camp. Man, right. I mean, how this thing shakes out. But Ryan Rollins has gotten some early notoriety. To me, that's a good thing.
Yes, but I'm kind of skeptical early on because I want to make sure that Gary Harris, Cole Anthony, like these. These kind of shorter guards, veteran, more experienced guys, won't be slotted ahead of him early on in the rotation. That's the only thing that kind of worries me about the situation. Now, if Doc goes ahead and say, hey, Rollins is the backup and then this and that, I'll feel a lot better. But right now, with a lot of uncertainty, with a crowded backcourt, you know, I want Rollins to have an opportunity to blossom and to showcase all these skill sets so we get a larger sample size with extended minutes so we can really see what that 40% shooting and that, yeah, you know, 6'11 wingspan, so we can really see over an extended period of time what it can do. But again, MJ, it's like I got to see how we come out of camp and what that rotation is, especially with that guard room. Cole Anthony was brought in for a reason. Gary Harris brought in for a reason. Yeah. He said it's to shoot clutch free throws in his interview, which I thought was pretty funny. But we got to see how that's going to shake out as far as rotation. But I'm, as you know, we've been singing Ryan Rollins' praises forever. Yeah. We love him here on this pod. But again, sometimes the politics and things like that, yes, veterans, things like that kind of come into play. So,
well, one thing we know for sure, I mean, it's all going to shake out in the wash. I mean, the training camp, you know, it's going to be continue to be super competitive. Yes, the exhibition season, the exhibition games, Doc could use that to put together combinations and eventually come up with the units and the combinations that he thinks are most effective. Yes, sir.
Are you going? Are you doing the game?
My first game will be on the 9th against Detroit at home. We've got Chicago on the road after that on the 12th.
So I get a chance to see preseason. This,
yeah.
Preseason? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Get a chance to see this team up close and personal.
Back in the saddle. Back in the saddle, babe. Back in the saddle.
That's the fun part about it. And we're here at District. Going to bring you everything that's going on. Every move this team makes, every step they take, we'll be right here watching them and bringing it to you. All right. Welcome back here at District. Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson. We are honored to be joined by a young lady who is doing a great job as a basketball TV analyst covering the Chicago Sky, the WNBA, the Big Ten. She's all over the place right now. Former coach, 24 years, Chris, as a coach with the University of Minnesota, Clemson, Texas Tech, Florida, Nebraska, Lincoln, St. Louis, also Arizona and Washington, out our way, out the old pack, the pack day. Shemmy Miller, mm-hmm, welcome to Here District. How you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you guys for having me.
First question: What is shimmy? Where does that come from? Shimmy, is that what's going on with shimmy?
That's a nickname my big brother gave me, Robert. He passed away about 8 years ago, but my real name is Yashimbra. Yashimbra.
Wait, hold it. Yashimbra.
Yeah,
wow. Okay. Backstory, please. Backstory, please. Yashimbra.
All right. So my mother was a German English white woman named Bonnie Lee. Okay. My older brothers are Robert Lee and Darren Charles. And she thought that it would be cute to name me Yashimbra Tane. She got this from an Ethiopian cookbook. I kid you not. You can't make this up. Why a German English woman, white, blonde hair, blue eyed woman who never could cook, would have an Ethiopian cookbook in the first place is beyond me. But she was thumbing through the Ethiopian cookbook. It came across the name Yashimbra Asa, which is actually a dish. It literally translates to chickpea. It's made with chickpeas. She thought it would make a great name. Brought me home from the hospital. My brother, who was 11 years older than me, said, "This is the stupidest name I've ever heard of. We're gonna call it Shimmy." I've been Shimmy ever since.
Now, were you Shimmy or Yashimbra in elementary school? Anybody ever call you
Shimmy?
Okay, I got you.
No, if you call me Shimmy, that means you don't know me, or you want something from me, like a bill collector or something like that. So no, shimmy. If you call me Yashimbra, that means you don't know
me. Right. Okay. Yeah. I got you. Mm-hmm. See, there's always a fascinating story behind names like that. You know, I was named after a Harlem Globetrotter, Marcus Haynes, one of the greatest ball handlers of all times. My father saw him play in the '50s and told my mother, if I have a son, I'm going to name him after this Marcus guy, M-A-R-Q-U-E-S. So that's my claim.
Well, Mom had a name for me if I was going to be a guy. If I was going to be a boy, she was going to name me Cesar Cedeno.
Sure. Okay, Cesar Cedeno.
So
okay.
I honestly don't know which is worse, Cesar or Yashimbra. Right. I don't know.
Why did she?
So.
I mean, was she a baseball, a German lady? White baseball?
No,
she just liked the rhythmic sound of Cesar Cedeno. Okay.
Just doing too much. When I was a basketball coach, I have an acronym. It's DTM.
You're doing too much.
And my mom was DTM with my name. Funny. She was like, "This is my last child. I'm gonna go out with
okay,
a bang."
Okay, so now
MJ, yes, quick question, because I had to look this up. I don't know the etymology or whatever it is behind my name. where did you guys get my name? Well, my full name, Shimmy, by the way, is Chris Stein.
Yeah.
So Chris for short, but Chris Stein is my full name. So MJ, what is that? What's up with that?
So here you go. So I wanted to name you Christian, you know, C-H-R-A, you know, just kind of a religious thing, Christian Johnson. I like that.
Okay.
Your mom wasn't feeling that. And so we decided on Kristen, K-R-I-S-T-A-N. And then at the last moment, she threw in that extra A. So Kristen, it became, instead of Kristen, it became Kristen. And now your middle name is Iman, which means faith in the unknown. Yes. It's kind of the Islamic thing. So I was back in my fake Muslim days when I was sneaking some bacon on the side with breakfast and all that. But,
wow.
But Iman, that's the middle name. But it's faith in the unknown. But your mom changed that the last, you know, your ladies do.
I appreciate that. Well, I was curious. But it turns out, last thing on this, it turns out it's Danish. The name Kristen is Danish. If you Google it, it's a bunch of Danish folks named Kristen. So there's that.
So now that they can call you.
Thank you.
They dubbed him Shimmy Stani Loco in high school for reasons we won't get into. But anyway, as I used to always say, they should have called you Stani Even Keeled. That would be
that would have been a lot better.
Lot more effective in terms of snatching whistles off a referee's neck and stuff. But anyway, I digress. So listen, let's go to the news, the current happening, Shimmy. We got you on here, man, and no better time to have you on here. Nafisa, Queen Fee. Queen Fee comes out with both barrels. Homage to.
Oh, okay.
Okay, your feelings about her.
What do they do now?
My daughter Shiloh said they gave her snaps in English class for something. Snap. But
snaps are bad.
Her coming out bold, big, and beautiful, talking about some concerns she has about that game. Talk about that.
Well, like she said, Marcus, she said it wasn't necessarily about this game. And I actually thought that particular play where she got hurt, it just came out, too, that she's out for a while. She tore two ligaments, broke her shin or something crazy like that. So she's going to be out for a while. But I thought that particular play was clean. But it was the 20 plays before that play.
Okay.
And then the 200 plays before that play in the series and the 2000 plays this whole season, the officiating this entire season has been atrocious across the board. I've talked about it on air. People have talked about it in the studio, players, coaches, whatever. What I love about what Fee did and the timing, and I saw Mad Dog's rant this morning and he got it all wrong. Like the timing of it was, this was her exit interview. And you guys know how exit interviews go. So this was her time to speak. So she was going to maximize her exit interview. But I love Nafisa. I recruited her years ago when I was an assistant at Nebraska. And she was out in Jefferson City and out in the suburbs of St. Louis. And she's always been like that. She's a leader. She went to Incarnate Word, one of the most successful girls basketball program in the state of it's in the Catholic school in the state of Missouri. She's a winner. She's a leader, outstanding parents. So the fact that she would be the one to put it down and say what everybody else was thinking and wanted to say, or for whatever reason, didn't want to lose endorsements, didn't have, and she's got the platform now. Basically what she's saying is, I got my own league. Me and my husband, we got our own league.
Yes.
So I don't need this. I want this, but I don't need this. But it's time for me to speak up.
Yes, and I think that was a big kind of part about that statement, who it was coming from. It was coming from the co-founder of Unrivaled. They run, like, arguably what I would consider one of the biggest competitors is 3-on-3, granted. But the way they're paying the salaries, the notoriety, the cachet associated with that league, it's like that's the place to be. And so for me, looking at it, I felt like it was a very strategic statement. The fact that she brought in Caitlin, Angel, and Paige FC, their nation, their fans, and dropped dime on private conversations that her and the commissioner had, where she's talking about Caitlin should be thankful on her knees praising Jesus that she has all these endorsement deals. Shimmy, what do you think about that side of it, bringing in everybody? Was that a smart strategic play, or should she have left those young ladies out of the conversation?
No, it was very strategic. It was very intentional. She knew what she was doing for exactly the same reasons that you laid out, Chris. What she did now is, this is the first time now you got Angel Reese's fans
and Caitlin Clark's fans, they're on the same page. Now it's like, it was, what's the song? Okay, ladies, now let's get in formation. Like, you got all the fans in formation now. And I would be curious, Caitlin has said that she's going to actually make a statement during her exit interview tomorrow. So I'll be curious to see, because she's also someone who's very, very intentional. That's why she didn't make a statement like yesterday when everybody else was making emotional tweets and posts. Caitlin is not, she's not dumb. So she's going to actually make her statement tomorrow. But Nafisa knew what she was doing. Mm-hmm. And then I also love that she had receipts. Like, you can't go back. Kathy can't go back and say, hey, you misunderstood me. It was obvious that she had receipts and had direct quotes from that meeting that those two had in February.
And so the last time, last time I saw Kathy Engelbert, she was like doing the Dougie at the All-Star game during that 24-hour
With the stud,
she was dancing. Everything seemed all good. But here's my thing. A collective bargaining negotiation doesn't get real until you start throwing stones at each other. Until you start talking about each other. So you start having some acrimony. I've been through them. We had Junior Bridgman, vice president of the Players Association, Bob Lanier, Steve Mix, Quinn Buckner, all on the same Milwaukee Buck team during the salary cap, the defining the salary cap between the players in the league. So, I mean, is this just kind of part of the process? I mean, you got to dig in. You got to show the league that you mean business, that you're not going to just take any old kind of philosophy they want to throw out at you, and narrative they want to give to the public. Is this just kind of a part, you know, you've been around for a while, just kind of the grand overview? Is this just kind of a part of a negotiation, or something bigger is at play?
I remember, well, one, I think this might be it for Kathy. I think this might be her last.
Because what? Why do you say that?
It's been a series of missteps and mismanagements during her tenure. And they never really, since the league began 28 years ago, they haven't really found a commissioner that has really like stuck. They've had commissioners who's lasted like one year. But this generation of players, they're different. They're built different. They're more savvy. They're more media savvy. They're smarter. They're more informed. They have a team behind them. They're not settling for the way things were. They're not settling for the crumbs that they've been given. They know their worth. They know their worth. This is not like, I think about the WNBA. When it first came out, like I actually had an invite to training camp with the Detroit Shock and didn't last very long at all. But like, this is not my WNBA. This is not Cheryl Swoops, Lisa Leslie, Rebecca Lobo's WNBA. These new women, they're just more informed, more educated, more empowered, and more emboldened than ever.
The thing I noticed, Shimmy, about this generation, Kyrie just tweeted something where he quote tweeted Fee's exit interview and was like something to the effect of, they're going to learn not to mess with our generation. I think it's truly a generational thing, to where things from my generation, I couldn't fathom someone from my generation coming out exit interview saying the things that she said, directly challenging a commissioner. I think that generation has a level of DGAF that the generations before them don't have. No, they do. Because you see it, you saw it all throughout the different social movements that have taken place since 2020. The brazen nature of protesters at the Black Lives Matter movement in L.A. flipping a cop car in L.A. For me, that was just like, wow. But it also, a friend of mine spoke to how that generation just is not necessarily conditioned the same. That takes me to this next question I have for you about these CBA negotiations. Now, the context of the conversation Fee was talking about was about fouls and hard fouls and physicality of the league. Now, do you think that doing something like that, coming out on a platform like that, will it help the young ladies achieve their goal of more salaries, more respect, you know, better facilities, everything that they're asking for, or does it hinder their plight to do things like that, to come out and speak out? Like, what are your thoughts on that specific nature as it pertains to the CBA negotiations?
Marcus, you say this all the time. I mean, it's your handle, right? Old school. Like, I'm old school. I'm an older generation. I graduated from college in 1994. I played for one of Pat Summitt's former players, Trish Roberts. She played for Pat. She thought she was Pat. Mm-hmm. And so when she would say, run 100 suicides, I would say, okay, you know, do you want me to do them backwards or sideways, or how do you want me to do it now? And I watched this generation over my 24 years of coaching change. It was no longer like run because I said so. It was, they started to question. They want to know why you got me doing this. What are the benefits of this doing this? NIL changed things. The portal changed things. And so this, it's a shift. And I don't think, to answer your question, Chris, I don't think this is going to hurt these young women. Now, I don't know what's going to happen this year. We don't know if there's going to be a season next season, right? Or this season, right? But I do know this. I think they are willing, they, because they have options. They don't just have to go overseas now to make their money. They have options. So they finally have some leverage. They're finally in a position where they can say, hey, if we have to sit out this season, we'll sit out this season. And then you'll see the millions of dollars, you know, that we are costing you, or that we make you. And it's like Chelsea Gray said, they think the league, you know, they're more, the league is more important than the players. The players make the league.
Facts.
And there's finally a financial incentive, you know, that supports that. It all comes down to money. Yeah. It all comes at the end of the day, that's what it all comes down to. And these players finally feel like after 28 years, they're in a position now where they can actually make some tangible demands.
Well, and I thought Jemele Hill, we had her on the show a few weeks back. She brought up a good point in terms of, I mean, the ratings and the attendance, even though it's broken records. Okay, so it's still can be improved upon, but the valuation of these franchises is going through the roof. The expansion that we're seeing in the WNBA. I mean, the league, you don't look to expand, you know what I'm saying, unless there's some successful factors involved in that. So I don't think the league can no longer pretend that, well, we're doing you a favor, like the commissioner said about Caitlin Clark. We're giving you that platform to make $16 million off the court. These franchises are worth a whole lot of money, and it continues to escalate.
Caitlin Clark was a millionaire before she stepped foot on a WNBA court.
That's the point. Yep.
You know, Caitlin Clark built her brand from what she did at Iowa. That didn't have anything to do with the WNBA.
Wow.
You see an organization like first year, like the Valkyries, that come in, set, you know, sell out literally every single game, unbelievable fan base. Just totally, I wouldn't say overachieved, but they did very well. I did not expect them to be a playoff team, Shimmy. Is that indicative? Now you have expansion going to Toronto with the Tempo, and then I believe, is it Portland?
Portland, Portland, then Detroit, then Cleveland. Yeah, then,
oh, really? So
yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Wow. Just touch on that. Touch on that and just how, you know, the sort of the perception of the WNBA has now changed, not because of Caitlin Clark, but because of the collective just growth of the players in the league.
It is the players, Chris. It is the players. It's not the coaches. It's not the GMs. It's the players. And these are billionaires. I think right now, currently the WNBA, they have five or six teams are run by billionaires. Like the Chicago Sky, where I work, those guys are millionaires. They're multimillionaires. But the Liberty, Sparks, they're billionaires. And these billionaires are not investing, you know, their money to play these payers, fly them all over, you know, they get charter jets now, build these multi-million dollar practice facilities. I don't know if you guys have seen the plans
renderings
for the Sparks facility. Oh,
unbelievable.
My gosh.
It's unbelievable.
El Segundo, it's like over $200 million that they're investing in a practice and training facility.
Yep.
These billionaires, you don't become billionaires by just throwing your money into stuff that's not going to get you anything in return.
Fact.
So these, they're not stupid. So I just, you look at the growth of the league, you look at all the people right now that are trying to buy, like they're trying to the group from Boston's trying so hard to buy the Connecticut Sun. And for whatever reason that I don't know, it's being blocked by Adam and Kathy, but, it's just the players. It's they're better than they've ever been before. They're bigger, they're stronger, they're more athletic than they've ever been before, and they're smarter, they're more savvy than they've ever been before. They know their worth.
Okay, well, let's talk about these players as we segue a little bit into the WNBA playoffs. Now, first off, the Fever without Caitlin looked pretty darn good. What is that saying? I mean, Kelsey Mitchell, you know, you tell me about her. I mean, I know she had a great playoff run, 22 points a game. I'm sure you had an understanding of just how good she was, but what does that say about this team to play as well as they did without one of the superstars of the league and getting Caitlin Clark?
Well, it starts with Stephanie White, the coach of the team, in my opinion. Steph's did a phenomenal job at Connecticut when she was the head coach with the Connecticut Sun. This is her second stint with Indiana. She left the WNBA to coach at Vanderbilt. That was a disaster. That's not her niche, right? Yeah. She's not a college coach. She's built for the WNBA. And so she did a phenomenal job of creating buy-in. I think they had a really strong culture to begin with. I thought they did a really good job in the offseason of signing Kelsey. I thought that was their most important move, is to re-sign Kelsey, because people forgot how good Kelsey is because she's been mired, you know, in this underachieving franchise in Indianapolis for her whole career. Yeah. Kelsey Mitchell was a baller. She's Big Ten Player of the Year. I coached against her when she was at Ohio State. She got buckets. Yeah. They did a great job of bringing in Sid Colson, who provided, you know, some strong leadership. And then Steph and her staff, they just were, it was like a Jenga piece. Like they were pulling pieces out. Oh, you got an ACL. Well, now we got to pull this one out, and we got to figure out a way to put you in here. And then, oh, you got broke your foot. Let's you out. But now we got to plug in with this piece. And they did a masterful job.
Yeah, I thought they did a great of the signings, some of their pickups. I know we look at them as replacement players, but these were some high level basketball players that were already in the league. And so they just got an opportunity to shine. And regarding that last game against the Aces, you know, if Kelsey doesn't go down with whatever happened with her, AB fouls out. I mean, it's like, it could have been very interesting.
It was overtime.
It surprised me that they hung with the Aces. Now, that leads me to this question. What's up with the Aces? Now, they look like world beaters. They went on an amazing winning streak. Is this one of those situations, Shimmy, where styles make fights, and this was just sort of one of those matchups that gave them problems?
And I love Becky Hammon, right? I mean, I'm not going to argue with anything that somebody has done, something that I would kill to do, which is win a championship as a coach, right? Mm-hmm. She's done it twice, you know, with the Aces. I thought Stephanie out-coached her this entire series, including last night. Like, if you go back to the game last night, that game should not have gone to overtime.
Overtime.
The last two possessions of regulation, your MVP doesn't even touch the ball.
Yeah, yeah.
And no disrespect to Jackie Young. Jackie Young had 30 points last night. But you have an MVP. Aaliyah Boston had already fouled out of the game. MVP, four-time MVP, Asia Wilson is being guarded by Bree Turner, someone who at times didn't even get off the bench this season. That's where the ball needs to go to. You have two straight possessions to end the game where Asia doesn't even touch the ball. Like I'm sitting here and Rebecca and Ryan, you know, the analysts in the game, they're not talking about that. And I'm like, why are you guys not talking about that? That's what you need to be talking about. That's
a great point.
Game should have never gone to overtime. I thought Steph did a phenomenal, she coached her butt off.
Well, and that jumped out at me. It's like, why is Asia Wilson not touching the ball here down the stretch? But to digress for a minute, you talked about Steph being at Vanderbilt, not cut out to be a college coach as opposed to a pro coach. Explain to us, is there a difference? It's on the men's side. We got the Rick Pitinos, Jimmy Lynam, who I played with the Clippers, coach at St. Joe. These college coaches on men's side, they come in cracking the whip. They come in like you're talking about the coach you played for, you know, jump how high. The pro is a little bit different game. They used to try and get me, Shimmy, to go hard at shoot around. Brad Greenberg, who used to be an executive with the Portland Trail Blazers and Sixers. I think he drafted Allen Iverson. But Brad was an assistant coach, and he'd tell me in shoot around, come on, get your ass in gear, come on. I'm like, look, Brad, hey, I can give it to you now, I can give it to you tonight. I can't give you all out 100% both times. On the women's side, is that similar, or is it a totally different dynamic? You explain just kind of what's that about.
It's similar. And so with Steph, it was the opposite. Steph is more of a pro coach. Look, Steph want a ball. She want X's and O's. Like, that's what Steph is interested in. She just want to show up. Steph's trying to, you know, run practice, coaching games, strategize X's and O's. And at the collegiate level, there's so much of your job that's not X's and O's is just this much of what we do. Mm. We got to recruit.
Right.
We got to manage moods, especially on the women's side. You got to manage moods and personalities. You got to deal with parents. You got to deal with boosters. You got to raise money. You got to, you know, you got a lazy academic advisor who just sticking your kid in the wrong class. You got to handle that. You got a lazy trainer who trying to hold your kid out because she got a sore big toe. You got to handle that. And so Steph was just like, I just want to, you know, coach. And this is obviously, I haven't talked to Steph about this. This is my perspective going from, you know, what she did. I did what she did for 24 years. And you go from the pro level to the collegiate level. It's a whole different ball game. And now it's like, she's just more free. You go, she goes back to Connecticut and she's back. Everybody was like, when she got hired at Connecticut, everyone was looking at what she did at Vanderbilt. And they were like, oh, that's a terrible hire. That's a terrible hire. I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about. Steph White can coach. Mm. And then she takes Connecticut back, you know, to the semis again or to the finals. So,
yeah, I get you.
And then you see what she did at Indiana. Yeah.
That's so now give us a piece of advice. I got a 16-year-old daughter, Shiloh, really 6'1". Can move, can shoot, real fluid.
I've seen the clips.
You start talking about these moods. Chris is her workout guy. He's the person that puts it. give us a piece of advice just as a 16-year-old. I mean, what's the best approach in terms of working? I say working with as opposed to handling. My old coach, John Wooden, say you handle horses, you work with players. In terms of working with Shiloh, give us some advice in terms of a 16-year-old, that mindset, the hormones, all the stuff going on with a young lady like that. Because I'm at the end of my rope sometimes.
Look, I had to learn, and I had to learn this over the course of my career, to not take anything personal. Because it's not about you.
So slam the door in my face, slam the door in my face, get out of here, Dad. Just don't take it personal.
You know, right, don't you. Take okay. it personal because okay. it's not about you.
Yeah.
So when they come in and they got a funky attitude and they don't want to work, it's not because it's not about you. It's not because of anything you said, anything you've done. It doesn't have anything to do. It's just them. So you can't take it personal. And the other thing that I've learned how to do is I just learned how to meet them where they are.
Yeah.
So not, you know, I don't, because that gap between my expectation and their reality, all that space in between is frustration. And the wider that gap, the more frustrated I get. So I just would try to go in each day, meet them where they are, and then let's help them get here today, or let's help them get here today.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you something. Woo-wee, 24 years and of that. And I love I love most of my former players.
At least you're honest.
But my goodness.
Yeah, Coach Wynn used to say, Shimmy, that he loved all his former players. He didn't like them all. He did quite a few. He didn't like at all, but he loved them all, you know. So that's what sounds like you're saying.
I didn't even love them all.
You can't even say
most of them, though. Most of them I did.
So the attributes that you mentioned, in terms of meeting them where they are, setting goals, let's get better. I mean, those sound like that they would be highly transferable to whatever player we're talking about, men, male, female, whatever. Do you think a woman's coach can be successful coaching in the men's game? On what level, collegiate, pro? What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think on any level, Marcus, you look at Becky Hammond, at least, unless they're all lying, it sounds like all her former Spurs players really respected her. You look at Lindsay Harding, who's on JJ's bench. She was with, I think she was with Sacramento, maybe the G League team with Sacramento, did really, really well. Now she's on JJ's bench with the Lakers.
Jenny Bucek of Indiana. I mean,
Jenny is phenomenal.
She set up the defense and doing
Jenny.
All that.
Me and Jenny go way back. Yeah. Kara Lawson. I know she didn't work out with the franchise, with the Pelicans, Teresa Weatherspoon, but I heard Zion in his presser the other day said that he spent all summer working out with her. So I do. In the same way that, you know, some men are really successful women's coaches and some are not. You just can't relate. And you just see more men coaching women's basketball. It's more accepted for men coaching women's basketball than it is women coaching men's basketball. But I honestly think it comes down to that particular person. I think Dawn Staley would be phenomenal at any level coaching men, college, the pros. She just has that kind of personality. Okay. But there are some female women coaches that I'm like, no, like you couldn't walk into a boys' high school gym and get their respect.
But now would they, would she get the respect of a women's team? Are you saying there's a, or is it just across the board? She's not the kind of coach that
I think
feel...
across across the board. I think personality, relatability, trust. I think if I don't trust you, then you're never going to be able to get the most out of me as a player if I don't trust you. I think that is genderless.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, my very first coaching job, I coached the boys' high school team in Michigan.
Okay.
And they didn't want to listen to a word I said. I was right out of college. I was 21 years old. They weren't trying to hear me. And I walked in one day and I had my shorts on, my hoop shoes. I had my little knee brace and they started laughing. They were like, "What you about to do?" And I said, "I'm going to play with y'all." And they just started, I mean, it was like a scene from like a movie and it was like Coach Carter Part 2 and they just started laughing. And then I played and busted their ass. It wasn't even a good boys team. We weren't good. And I was right out of college. I was in great shape. I just graduated and I never had an issue like with them again. Had an issue.
That's the best teacher sometimes, getting out there and doing it. Now, looking at your t-shirt, you told us off air that those were some of the best bigs. Some of the names, Luca, Nas, I can't see them all. There's one name missing. Go ahead.
Who's that?
Well, not Asia Wilson. Asia.
Okay. So let me explain. So this shirt, this is actually my favorite bigs. And I made this shirt a long time ago, first of all.
Okay, that's fair.
I really need to like remake the shirt now because Luca, I don't even think he's a big anymore. I don't think he's a big anymore. Nas Hillman, who was on this shirt, I made this when she was like a freshman at Michigan. She plays for Atlanta Dream now. She's out there shooting threes. Megan Gustafson, I made this when she was at Iowa. Now she's out there just catching shoot threes. I don't even count them as bigs anymore. If I had to remake the shirt now, Asia Wilson would 100% be on the list.
Four-time MVP.
I put Camila Cardoso on the list now, too. I love the way she's evolved.
I love Cardoso. I love Cardoso.
I do, too. Yeah. But in terms of Asia, is it time to stamp her as the, as they say, the GOAT? Back in my day, GOAT meant that you were like the foil. Now it means you're the greatest of all times. Four-time MVP. In 6 years, she just passed. Yeah. I think Cheryl Swoops won 3 MVPs. She's got 4 right now. In 6 years.
Wow.
Is she I don't know. She got a case to be the.
Let me ask you guys a question. Did we say that Magic or Kobe or LeBron, did we start calling them the GOAT when they were still playing or did we wait a little bit? Like, when did we start calling people GOAT when they were only like 6-7 years into their career?
Yeah, I mean, even Michael, I mean, you know, you had to, I think, Chris, you tell me, but I think you had to wait until the whole body of work was in. Even though Michael with the 3 in a row and some of the things that he had done on the floor to get them there made a strong case to be mentioned in that breath. LeBron, kind of the king, kind of is, I won't say self-anointed, but I think you got to wait till it's all said and done. Chris, what do you think?
I agree. I mean, I think the full body of work, like Shimmy said, does matter. I hate when we prematurely try to label folks as the best to do it before they're done. Because we don't know what else they're going to do. She might do some more stuff that might add on to the mantle or, you know, there might be a flip side to that.
Exactly.
But what do you think? What do you think, Shimmy?
I think she's the best women's basketball player in the game today. That's what I think. I'm not ready to call her the GOAT yet. You know, because the MVPs, I think that matters. That's so important. But you're always going to have some hater who votes, especially in the WNBA, because it's anonymous. Like, at least in the NBA, you know who you're voting for, right? In the WNBA, like a couple years ago, somebody voted for her 4th. Like, you know, I think that right now she's the best women's basketball player in the game today. I still am like Diana Taurasi.
Okay.
Lisa Leslie, like, they had pretty phenomenal careers too. I'm not ready to anoint her as the.
I, I was going to ask you, who's your all-time favorite? Would it start with those two? Who's your, like, just all-time favorite that you just love watching play? Just
Maya your... Moore. Okay. My goodness, okay. Was Maya Moore good? But I'm going to have to say Diana Taurasi.
Yeah.
DT.
Wow, that's a good choice. Well, listen.
From Don Lugo, Chino Hills.
Okay. But well, Jimmy, we appreciate you, Jimmy Miller, coming by, spending some time with us here at the Here District. WNBA is getting exciting on a whole lot of different fronts with the finals and everything happening with the collective bargaining agreement and all that. So we'll have you back on again when this thing kind of settles down a bit. But thank you so much for spending some time with us on Here District.
I appreciate you guys. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.